हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनौभुनक्तु सवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्रीमद्वैत जगदाधर श्रीवासदि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Okay, bottom of 59. Lord Shiva's lotus feet were worshipped by both the demigods and demons, but still, in spite of his exalted position, as soon as he saw Lord Brahma was there among all the other demigods, he immediately stood up and offered him respectful obeisances, and offered his respectful obeisances to Kasyapa Muni. He immediately stood up and offered him respect by bowing down and touching his lotus feet, just as Vamanadeva offered his respectful obeisances to Kasyapa Muni. All the sages who were sitting with Lord Shiva, such as Narada and others, also offered their respectful obeisances to Lord Brahma. After being so worshipped, Lord Brahma, smiling, began to speak to Lord Shiva. Right, so we see is that here, Shiva is naturally standing up and offering respects to Brahma, right, as his father. But we see even Daksha was being careful about that. So he thinks he's not respectful, he doesn't know how to behave, but he knows the situation. When the demigods comes, he's a senior. Right? So simply in a loophole that Daksha's trying to use the thing of him being the son-in-law, that therefore he should be the most respectful. He's putting son-in-law as more important than being an avatar of the mode of ignorance. And Daksha being respected and powerful in the universe, but Shiva being unlimitedly more powerful, and that he wasn't making this connection. He was putting all that aside because he was his son-in-law. Because for him, his duty as Prajapati and the whole family thing was the most important, so naturally then he would put the emphasis there. Does that make sense? Yeah. 48 to 41. In his purport to verse 41, Srila Prabhupada explains the reason for Brahma's smile. Lord Brahma was smiling because he knew that Lord Shiva is not easily satisfied. Not only easily satisfied, but easily irritated as well. He was afraid that Lord Shiva might be in an angry mood because he had lost his wife and had been insulted by Daksha. In order to conceal this fear, he smiled and addressed Lord Shiva as follows.
Can we say that
Yeah, but when you're in a formal assembly, which takes the precedent? You know, if Shiva and Shatsati had gone to visit his house, then naturally then he would act as the son-in-law. But when they're in a yajna of the demigods, where it's all about the sacrifice and who's in what position and who gets what share and all those kind of things, then he far outstrips Daksha in respectfulness. You know, because Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, they're the top ones to be respected in that scenario. Because they're the ones who all the yajna and everything are the main ones, and then everybody else after that. Is that something? So from that angle, so he can't put all these other considerations aside, right? But he's putting all of them aside because that one's been put aside. Now he's claiming that Shiva is uncultured and all this kind of thing, because the most important thing in the world is respecting him as his father-in-law, because the aspect of family life is the most important thing in the universe. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, it's not an uncommon thing. I've seen parents do that also. Because Manu says that if you're with the teacher and the parent comes, without the permission of the teacher, you don't offer respect to the parent. Right? Because you're under the control of the teacher. But I've had parents complain when the boys go by that they don't leave, come over, you know, offer respect. You know, these, what are you teaching respect, this and that, but they don't understand what's respect at all. It's the same kind of attitude. You know what I'm saying? So that's the difficulty. So it's not an uncommon thing. Verses 42 to 49, Brahma glorifies Lord Shiva and asks for restoration of those injured. Lord Brahma said, "My dear Lord Shiva, I know that you are the controller of the entire material manifestation, the combined father and mother of the cosmic manifestation, and the supreme Brahman beyond the cosmic manifestation as well. I know you in that way." That's how he knows him. Daksha and the other demigods know him in different ways, they just know him as a demigod. He actually knows him as, you know, his position as a controller, as a Purusha, as an incarnation of the Lord, as an expansion of the Lord. Like, he knows all these things. That's what he knows. But Daksha didn't know. "My dear Lord, you create this cosmic manifestation, maintain it, and annihilate it by expansion of your personality. Exactly as a spider creates, maintains, and winds up its web." So then this aspect is there, that he's dealing with this, so even though technically he's the father, so on the social thing that's there, but on the other side then that's there. So it's another thing if Daksha had come, offered his respects, and saying all these same things like Lord Brahma says, and then Shiva, you know, then humbly just says, "No, I'm just your son-in-law," then that works. But no, Daksha's taking that exclusively over even just how the universe is managed, let alone the Vaishnava and transcendental aspect and how it's not different from the Lord. That aspect he's not even considered. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Why would he say that he created
this
cosmic manifestation, maintains it?
Because, see, Brahma is a jiva, and he's doing the creation, but Shiva is actually, means in this form, a transformation of Vishnu Tattva. And so the whole manifestation is going on by Maya, and he's controlling Maya. So technically, Maya is his energy. That's why, unless at the same time as his energy is coming from Sankarshan. Does that make sense? And at the same time, you have the element of the Sadashi, who's actually non-different. Just a different flavor, but actually Vishnu. The auspiciousness of Lord Shiva is described in this purport by Srila Prabhupada. In this verse, the word Shiva Shakti is significant. Shiva means auspicious, and Shakti means energy. There are many types of energies of the Supreme Lord, and all of them are auspicious. Brahma, Vishnu, and Maheshwar are called guna avatars, or incarnations of material qualities. In the material world, we compare these different incarnations with different angles of vision. But since all of them are expansions of the supreme auspicious, all of them are auspicious. Although sometimes we consider one quality of nature to be higher or lower than another. Right? So depending upon what you're discussing, you may consider. But if you're looking at it as the total material energy, then you don't make this distinction. It's just because the modes are what makes everything function. So the controllers of these modes then have a special position. But if you're going down to which mode, goodness, passion, or ignorance, then you make a distinction. So that's why it says sometimes. Some aspects we make the distinction, sometimes we don't. The mode of ignorance, or tamaguna, is considered very much lower than the others. But in the higher sense, it is also auspicious, right? Because it's doing a particular work. The example may be given herein that the government has both an educational department and criminal department. An outsider may consider the criminal department inauspicious, but from the government's point of view, it is as important as the education department. And therefore, the government finances both departments equally without discrimination, right? Because you can, the education goes on nicely because you have that criminal department to make sure that there's no disturbance. quote, "My dear Lord, your lordship has introduced the system of sacrifices through the agency of daksha, and thus one may derive the benefits of religious activities and economic development." You have another aspect is that you have Hiranyagarbha, means the Garbhadakshay Vishnu. Now there's the prayer to Vishukta to Garbhadakshay Vishnu is actually, if you hear it, it sounds exactly like it's a prayer to Lord Shiva. Because the point is he's entered the universe and he's dealing with the aspect of manifesting or giving the principles that are later manifest by Brahma as the ignorance that binds us. Right? All these, that being a column, is it a real column? But in one sense, it's functioning as one, but it's not, because it's the dead matter itself is not actually doing anything. It's the Lord's potency within it. So you have to create that illusion. So the universal form, that aspect, technically has that illusory aspect. It's real, but because the Lord is there, but the idea that you think that things are what they are when they're not, right? The forest is beautiful. No. The forest is dead matter that's able to, by the Lord's laws, carry a greater volume of Krishna's potency of beauty. Right? At the same time, as then it may be adjusted. What's beautiful, then you take, let's say a Wall Street, trader, okay? Then you take him out into the upstate New York, he gets bored, right? Nice drive, go out for half an hour, come back, that's good enough, It was very pleasant driving up to Boston or something, like that, or over to Connecticut where his house is, you know what I'm saying? But now let's say he's on the floor and he's made some plans and all that, and it's unfolding as he expected it to. Now to him, that is beautiful. No? It is. It's the guy's, his hairs are standing on end. Everything's happening. He's already planning his next vacation. All the other things. So, is that? So, does that make sense? Yeah. I love it when these examples are generally appreciated. We have some that goes, yes, and others going, what's he talking about? Okay. So, therefore, then, as Hiranyagarbha, that aspect, he's creating all that. But that goes back to who is actually the one that does the primary creation. Is Sankarsana. Right? It's Mahavishnu. And he's the devotee of Sankarsana. His Sankarsana's potency that gets him to do what he does. So when the Lord glances, the aspect of false ego in the Lord's glance is Shiva. So it's non-different from the Lord. Right? And then there's time. Right? So there's so many aspects. So the whole thing is everything's manifest and created because of ignorance. If you don't add ignorance, you won't have a creation. Does that make sense? So that's why from all these different angles you can take these different individual demigods and point out their greatness and how everything's going on because of them. And because of this, then the common person becomes bewildered and thinks that it's the demigods that are special. But as Madhvacharya points out, is that when the Shukta is about, let's say, one of the demigods, and it's describing their glories, it's actually describing the glories of Vishnu that they are the medium for. You know what I'm saying? Just like, let's say, if I say, this glass of drink, this is such a nice drink, it's so refined, it's so well done, its color, it's this, everything like this. But I said glass. Right? Because if I pour the stuff on there, it means it manifests through the glass. So that's the thing, is the foolish living entities think it's the glass that's special. So when they're talking about Indra, they're not talking about that form in which you're seeing it, you're talking about that potency that is Indra, which is Krishna, or Vayu, or Agni. Does that make sense? So in the same way, you're talking about Shiva, you're talking about this aspect of the Supreme Lord. Just, he has more of that. He's a much greater personality and more powerful and more not different from the Lord than Agni and Indra and all them. Yes.
So the next point would be, what's the point of the sacrifice to the demigods when he's giving them the shares? Is this the point of success in the sacrifice or just in education?
No, it's part of the thing, because since all of them are representing the Lord in all these aspects, then you're worshiping the Lord in this way. In other words, you're basically either knowingly or unknowingly worshiping the Lord through his potencies. So some don't know it's the Lord, and so they actually think it's the demigod, and that's what's important. Well, some of them understand that it's the Lord as the universal form. Right? So these are the Hiranyagarbhas that we were talking about. So either from the platform of karma or from jnana or from yoga, then they have that appreciation. You know, it's not that Daksha doesn't know these aspects, but they're not his major focus. You know what I'm saying? Let us say you have a situation in which kid comes into the kitchen, there's something to eat, he, you know, takes it, he goes and eats it, and he likes what he eats. Okay? Now, does he know that his mother cooked it? But is he focusing on that aspect? No. Now let's say he's sitting down to eat, mother's serving and all that, and it's really nice and all that. Now is he? Now you'll be more conscious. You understand? So it's not that you don't know, but the effect is, it's as if you don't know. That's why we see previously it's always, you remember the Lord, you don't remember, it's very much more clear. You have the demigods, you have the demons, you have this and that. But now as we see here, as we're getting the third canto, and that will come up more as we get into, as we go on, up through the sixth canto, we have to point out is that what actually makes the devotional service and what actually makes the demoniac mentality. Because we'll just take it that the forms are there. You have this form is bad, this form is good. But it actually comes down to it's the connection to the Lord, which is better than the connection with devotion that's the best. Does this make sense? So we have to clear all that, because we have our attachments to the senses, to morality, to dharma, to, you know, liberation. So dharma, artha, kama, moksha. These anarthas mean these four. Right? You don't technically have anarthas in bhakti. Bhakti is pure. It's the dynamic principle that makes everything else function. But because of our attachment to dharma, artha, kama, moksha, these four lower states of consciousness then get in the way. Does that make sense? And we see is even if we get to the lowest stage of anandamoy, where it's just we understand the Brahman or understand the Lord's position as creator, maintainer, and destroyer, how he's pervading everything, but don't actually appreciate as a person, that also it gets in the way of devotional service. Right? So it always has to be, whatever it is you're engaging, the aspects of dharma, artha, kama, or moksha in the Lord's service, that it's about the Lord and pleasing the Lord. Does that make sense? Under your regulative principles, the institution of the four varnas and ashrams is respected. The brahmanas therefore vow to follow the system strictly. 44. Srila Prabhupada explains. The Vedic system of varna and ashram is never to be neglected. Right? So Prabhupada points out, never. He's not saying sometimes, sometimes not. It's just a principle that you don't neglect it. Now what level you're working on within it? Prominence is on Bhagavat, Pancharatric, Vedic, a combination. That's another thing. But it cannot be neglected. Otherwise, what's the form? Right? Now, let us say, okay, well, the artik is about the devotion. It's not about the paraphernalia. So then would it be, the thing is that, instead for artik is that, you know, we're not so ritualistic, so the pujari just stands there and just sits and looks at the deity and smiles and feels devotional. Right? You understand? How would you call it an artik? Right? So how do we know it's an artik? Because of the form. So how do we know it's human? Because of the form. So that's the point. You follow this, it's human. You don't follow this, it's not human. It's just that simple. Right? Just like, let's say we have a horse, okay? Now this horse has been trained. So it does things in a certain way. Now you have another horse, but it's not trained. It's called wild. You understand? So just because we have a head, two arms, and two legs, right? We got, you know, 10 toes, and we have prehensile, you know, fingers, but not prehensile toes, you know, then we say that makes us human. Right? I think they've come down, that's the major difference. We don't have prehensile toes, and monkeys do. Does that make sense? Yes?
Prehensile
means like your thumb. Like if you look at a monkey's foot, his foot looks like his hand. Because they can actually grab with their big toe. Well, we can't. So. They're maybe a little more hairy. Most of the time. I've seen people that are as hairy as a monkey.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Like that. You know. Like that. So... trying to get back to where we were before we got off on the monkey man there.
What makes human
different?
Okay, yes. So, therefore, if the person in the human form of life follows the Varnashram, so therefore they're trained, they're tamed, then we call that human. But if you're not, then that's considered wild. So you have a wild human and you have a trained human. That's all. You can't say, no, but we have to see it's all that. Why we're making this discrimination? It's like, means you're not intelligent enough to tell the difference between a trained horse and a wild horse? You know? That's the whole thing. So all this sentiment, but because the sentiment is simply to cover up the fact of sense gratification. That's the reason that the Vedic system is neglected, because then I can whimsically be engaged in sense gratification as I please, rather than I'm directed what is my sense gratification. But the worst, the saddest part is, this is the saddest part, is even though people are whimsically doing whatever they like on the emotional, social, you know, family, economic, all these things, they don't actually enjoy as much as the people who follow. You know, I mean, if you look at it, you go back in history, all the things that were considered luxury items came from India. You know, or the Far East, because they basically follow the same culture. So in other words, where anything that the first world deems as valuable and luxury comes from a place that they consider are savages, because they follow closer to the Vedic rather than not to the Vedic. And an interesting thing is brought out in Mahabharata, is that at one point when Damayanti was moving with a caravan of elephants, means there were some traders, and they were moving, some merchants going to the next place, and they had all their goods on elephants, because they had a lot of goods, right? You don't have as much goods, you have donkeys, or you have camels, or something, you know, unless you have tons of them, but if you have a lot of stuff, you move with elephants, right? And so then they're moving with the elephants, and then at one point, so these are all trained elephants. At one point, a herd of wild elephants just happened to come at the same time and cross paths. Wild elephants hate domesticated elephants. They know they're domesticated. And so they just went in and just wreaked havoc amongst them, killed them, this, that, fighting and everything. So then Damayanti again ends up, you know, out in the forest and something like that. You know, it's just more of the tribulations. But you understand? So the principle is the same species that wild abhors those of the same species that is trained. So therefore, that's why then those within the non-Vedic hate those in the Vedic. Right? Does that make sense? So to this point, like daksha, where you just neglect. You know what I'm saying? People will sit around and talk about that, you know, oh yes, things go back to, you know, Egypt, or they go back to Greece, or, you know, they go back to this, or even they'll take it back to China, but they'll never take it back to India. Even though those from those other places say it came from India. Right? You go to Thailand, and they have a massage there that's famous around the world, known as Thai massage. Right? And that massage comes from the temple called Wat Pho. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. Now, on the walls of Wat Pho, which is goes back some thousands of years, the systems for this massage are carved into the stone on the wall. In other words, the teacher wanted to make sure nobody forgot. Right? And so they still follow it exactly like it was there. Okay. Now, the doctor who taught that, he's known as, in Thai, he's known as Jihwako. In English, he's known as Zhivago. You ever heard of Dr. Zhivago? Yeah, so that's him. He was the Ayurvedic doctor or physician for Lord Buddha himself. So all that happened was is he moved out, went over to Thailand, I guess, to preach. Good thing he moved out, because after a short time they kicked everybody out of India. So he was on the cutting edge there, right? So then it maintained there. So they just followed the same thing that was there 2,500 years ago in India. And India somehow or another, how they just, you know, slips through their fingers. They know that's where it's from. I was talking with a Chinese doctor once about the medicine. He saw that, you know, how I was dressed. He figured, you know, from India and this and that. And then he started telling me how 2,500 years ago, the system was the same as in India. It was Ayurvedic. He very said it's an Ayurvedic. But after 2,500 years ago, because it was easier for them in Chinese, they stopped using all the Sanskrit mantras. But otherwise, they'd make the medicine and do everything with Sanskrit. So I guess it came to the point that not that many knew Sanskrit. And so then they just dropped it and started doing Chinese, and so therefore it started making its own adjustments. This makes sense. So they accept that. You know, so all over the world it's like that, but somehow it is here. So this is the principle, is that when you're dealing with something that does give rise to the transcendental and all that, those who don't like it, who are not interested in that, don't like it. So we shouldn't be surprised. It's just a standard thing. Now, daksha is an extreme example. Therefore, that's why we hear his story. Right? You don't hear just some, you know, small-time guy down at a dock somewhere, and he doesn't even have impressive tattoos, right? You know, just has a heart with a dagger and it says mom on it or something. You know, like that. And that's it. You know, it's kind of like, okay, whoopee. You know, like that. You know, he doesn't even have an anchor on the other arm, you know, so it's like, you know. So therefore, then, you know, and then he's doesn't like, you know, who wants to hear the story? But daksha, now this is the story to hear about. So that's the thing, is that the Vedas will give examples that will be universal. Everybody will be happy to hear about them. Right? And there to that intensity that no one could say, well, my situation's worse than that, or my situation's not included in that. Does that make sense? Yes.
Can we say that Varnashram is formalized version of the culture that's there in the spiritual world?
Yes, that's what you could say. Oh, it's just like, let's say if you have a how-to book, you know, like, how you say, sandwiches for idiots or something, right? You know, so what is it? Is that the guy who is, you know, that it, you know, sandwiches and he has some book he's working from? No, they just know the principle of how a sandwich works. Right? And so they put it together. So that means those who naturally, spontaneously serve Krishna in a cultural form that Krishna appreciates being interacted with. Right? That then is documented as the Vedic culture. So that's why Prabhupada is saying the system of Varna and Ashram is never to be neglected, because it's the practice of the spiritual world. That's all. It's that simple. So it's universal. For these divisions are created by the Supreme Lord Himself, and they represent the parts of His body, right? Not somebody else.
What is that?
That's a bubble machine. That is a serious bubble machine. I don't think I've seen such a thing. Okay. Okay, they're created by the Supreme Lord Himself for the not by someone else that He did, you know, gave it out to, you know, Indra to work out, and then Indra made a few mistakes, and so it needs to be adjusted because we're so much smarter than Indra, right? No, the Supreme Lord Himself for the upkeep of social and religious order in human society. Right? So that's the thing. The social means the whole economic and all the everything that goes along with that. And then the religious means that which is going to elevate you to the transcendental platform. Right? So in other words, my attitudes in ashram is what's going to help me make the varna spiritual. Because on its own, varna is just skills that you apply that create economic development. But because of your determination in ashram, you make the commitment to do this for Krishna. Right? It's probably more often that you would find a devotee committed in ashram to devotional service but doesn't know how to connect their work or the varna thing to Krishna. Right? Okay, the money's connected, but they can't see more than that. Right? That you would say that wouldn't be uncommon, right? Now, can you think of an instance where someone knows perfectly how to connect their varna to Krishna and they're doing that very nicely, but in ashram they wouldn't even have a clue or even think that it should be connected? It wouldn't happen, right? Why? Because the religious is what affects the social. How religious you are means how much you'll include the religious mood or attitude in the social. Right? If you're religious, your social elements have that flavor. If you're not religious, it won't. Does that make sense? So that's the whole thing, is that one has to know how this functions. It's made by the Lord. It's the Lord's body. You know, you say, oh, Shudras, you're discriminating. Why? We can't tell the difference between the Lord's feet and His hands and His midsection and His head. We can't tell the difference. If we can't tell the difference, that means there's no intelligence, because intelligence means the ability to tell the difference. Discrimination, now that's something of the mind. So that's the whole point, is we're actually functioning on a platform of the mind, but cloaking it behind saying about its intelligence. So that's the problem. The Brahmins, as the intelligent class of men in society, must vow to steadily respect this regulative principle. They must be, because if the Brahmins disrespect it, that's when it all falls apart. Because the Brahmins, as Manu says, it's their business to maintain the dignity of a religion, of the Varnashram system. The Vaishyas were, when the cows appeared, then the Vaishyas appeared to take care of them. When the society appeared, then the Kshatriyas appeared to take care of the people, the populace. But when Varnashram appears, the Brahmins are created to take care of Varnashram. So the common person follows Varnashram, but isn't so worried about its maintenance and development. Right? Does that make sense? Right? Yeah, just like Vaishyas aren't worried about administration or education, unless they can make money out of it. But they're worried about economics. Right? The Kshatriyas are worried about administration. That's their focus. It's not that they don't get money, they don't do this. Brahmins, then they worry about education. So does this make sense? So this is how it works, and everybody specializes. That's why it's good. Right? If you tried to do everything with your face, it might be tough. But if you support specialization, in other words, if this unpractical, archaic system of discrimination where my hand picks up the food and puts it into my mouth and my stomach digests it, and then my feet, using that energy, I get me around the place. you know, that I should, everything is just one and anything can do, so I can eat with my feet and I can digest with my head, and, or I can walk around on my head. Like that, you know. Does that make sense? So this is, we'll say this is foolish. This is, you know, absurd. But that's exactly what's happening when people say you don't make any discrimination. Because the point is if you want to get up and go somewhere, then what part of your body gets the favor? Right? The feet. Right? But if you want to eat, it's the mouth. Does that make sense? And who actually produces what the body would consider wealth and distributes it? Right? The stomach. What's valuable to the body? Food, right? But who takes care of the food and distributes it? The stomach, you understand? Yes.
So Brahmanas includes all Vaishnavas essentially.
Brahmanas, yes. Brahmanas means, Brahminical culture means the Vedic culture. That's what's misunderstood. So therefore, that means everybody would be following it. Though those who are Brahman by either by advanced and as Vaishnavas or Brahman by how you say conditioned nature, they're the ones that are going to be worried about seeing that it's followed and properly understood and practiced. So those who oppose it, they're not in a good position. They may consider themselves, because you can go out and get so many people to agree. If I take a modern view on things, I will get so many people that are so conditioned by the modern view that they actually think it's more intelligent and a more practical approach. So that's the easy part. Being right, that's a whole other thing. So as Prabhupada's pointing out, it's made by God Himself personally. Why? Because it's the culture He likes to interact with. He likes that Brahmins are doing the intellectual thing, and the Kshatriyas are doing this, and Vaishyas are doing this, and Shudras are doing. He likes that. Because then everybody has things that they do and interact. Ambarish Maharaj, Yudhishthira Maharaj relate to Krishna as what? Through what medium? Right? As kings, yes. Bhishma Dev. On the battlefield, you know, as he said, you know, that high moment of Bhishma and Arjuna and Krishna and that whole thing going on there, and then Bhishma on the bed of arrows, and then being respected as a Kshatriya, and then in giving instructions on Dharma to Yudhishthira, you know, with Krishna's, encouragement and direct, you know, you understand? So it's all in the Kshatriya medium. Arjuna, you know, and Krishna, that Kshatriya medium. Right? Krishna Sudama Brahmana through the Brahminical. But he's a Kshatriya, he's a Brahmin. You know, so you understand? So it gives the variety. Otherwise, we're saying everything's one, there's no variety, and then society becomes boring, and then everyone wonders why nothing's going on. So then what do we have to do? We have to introduce all the Western modern things to give the variety. And we're just saying being practical. But practical on what level? On the conditioned level, and that even that is in an impure state. It's not a purified conditioned level. Does that make sense? Yes.
I don't want to steal it more, but it always annoys me the freedom mongers in the Gap devotees. And like recently I heard that, yes, I agree to all this, but we shouldn't be so restrictive to new people who are coming to Krishna consciousness.
But it's the new people that can actually do it.
Yeah.
We're taking it as the new people can do it. It's the new people that are willing to do it. You know, that's the whole thing. Is that the new people, because they only see the externals, they're happy to follow those externals. The reason that we don't want to give it to them is because we ourselves are not convinced. Otherwise, what's the point? You know, so you join something, of course there's going to be something different, you know. You know what I'm saying? Just like this. Let's say someone comes and hangs out with the Goths. Okay? Now it's natural that they're going to, you know, go out and buy themselves some black fingernail polish and, you know, go looking around for a top hat or something, you know, far out. Okay? Now, the whole thing is now if we're excelling, no, you don't have to do that, slow down, you know, you're like that, that's not the real goth, you know, and stuff like that. But the point is that's the only thing that they know is that. With time, they'll understand the mentality, so all they do is copy. You know what I'm saying? They're not creating goth style. You know, they just see the few things. Okay, you wear black, you know, you do this and that, and okay, I'm a goth. But with time, they understand the mentality, the mood, the this, the that. You understand? So because we're not confident of the forms, and in the same point, we're not technically very confident of the mood either, because otherwise we'd be able to accommodate. And because of that weakness, then we think we project that onto the new people. Oh, don't do that. But if any of those, any individuals, except for if they're newer, but if they go back, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, then every one of them, from the moment they came in contact, they're doing what everybody else is doing. And if they weren't, in those days, they were considered smo. You know what I'm saying? Because it was understood the reason you didn't shave your head was just due to attachment to your hair that you thought it looked great. You know, I've been growing it so long. You know, this was 4 years of work, you know, and so, you know, they don't want to shave. You know, stuff like that. But in those days, people just, you know, moved to the temple, everything they had in their house, donated to the temple. You know, just they were fully given. So that is surrender. Now, the training that's there, how that will be done, you could say that wasn't as efficient as it could be. You can't say, oh, that's fanatic. No, that's not at all. That's the way everybody joins. Somebody gets into skiing. First thing they do is go out and buy, if they got the money, what's the latest thing, this and that, the clothes, the, you know, the whole ski thing, you know, where's the resort to go to, where's the thing, and then they're there. And every person who's an old ski person can understand they're the newbie there. Right? Because they look more ski, you know, enthusiast than the skiers do. Does that make sense? So that's the whole point, is that the new people take the secondary very easily. Now, it's not that you're forcing, but you should allow them at the speed that they take it to take it. But what they're doing is if they could take it quicker, they're not giving it to them.
Yeah.
So that's weak.
So he likes wants to make dynamics of it. He wants to be in charge of dynamics of others.
Yes, but the point is it's not about us being the controller and the enjoyer. It's about Krishna. So if someone needs to take 10 years to get serious, fine. You know, like I always give the example of Bhakta Jose in America. Every temple president knows him. He spent time in all the major temples. And this is the conversation I'm hearing 12 years after he's joined and moved into the temple. And he's still Bhakta Jose. Right? But I can't confirm if his last name was Imanis, but like that. But in any case. Does that make sense? So it's just, it happens. There is people like that, and everybody appreciates them because they do nice service, but they're not steady, they don't stay long. Somebody's been there a few months, somebody's been there 2 years, somebody's this and that. So it's kind of like, oh, where is he now? You know, someone's talking, oh, yeah, what temple is he in now? You know, it's kind of like, yeah, they're interested. Yeah, okay, cool. Oh, he's in Miami. Okay, cool. You know? You know, what's he doing there? Oh, he's doing this. Yeah, he did like that in our temple. It was an interesting conversation. You had all these senior men sitting around and all talking about this bhakta that they all knew for the last, you know, 15 years or whatever it was. Yes.
But they will say that it's actually misunderstanding of the principle. Because
yes.
The principle that, I mean, if people push the consciousness, whatever form it takes for them to accept.
Yes.
And if they're not ready to accept this form, then, you know.
You do whatever you can, but you start from principle. In other words, you're giving him principle, but what happens, what he's talking about, is we take it that the form is Krishna consciousness. And because we think that that form won't work, we're technically not giving him much Krishna consciousness.
It's misapplication.
Yeah, and the only reason we would think like that is we ourselves don't, and we ourselves are careful about it, so that means we're missing out on the principle, they're missing out on the principle. Right? And you do have, just to indicate here, is that there are individuals who, seeing those who are favorable to the Vedic, but also only see on the external platform, then sometimes they avoid getting too Vedic just because these individuals make such a scene about it. You know? So when they're not so pro-Vedic, it's generally because those who are pro-Vedic many of the times are so external that they don't see the principle either. Like that. So to avoid that, they try to keep things more dynamic. But you'll see is that those individuals then are focusing on things like getting the chant, read, all the direct activities of devotional service, so they push that. Now whether the secondary attributes they push or not, they're generally quite liberal about that. But they themselves generally will practice it quite well. So you'll see they follow it nicely. They've given the essence. Now, whether those around them are very serious in the secondary or not, that they're not worried about. They're only worried about the primary, so you have to distinguish them. So when you bring up Vedic, they want to make sure that it's real, not just another external, because they know that the primary is more important. So what we're talking about here, the question is about those who are external on their understanding of Krishna consciousness, and therefore try to water down that external, because that's all that they're dealing with. Make it, quote-unquote, dynamic. You know, it's just like, let's say, a person comes over to dinner, you know, like that, or a snack and that. And I take the lemon juice, you know, like that, nice lemon juice. You know, I've made it really well. And I give everyone a glass of that. But one person, I take it and fill the glass half with water and then put that lemon juice. And I give him. He's going, you know, everybody's going, wow, this is fantastic. Full flavor. He's going, this is not so good. You understand? But that's the philosophy. Watered down is somehow another more tasty. But everyone knows watered down doesn't give much taste. Right? So you have to be expert on how not to water down, but to not get distracted by the secondary. That takes maturity. Right? So you have to judge on this and applying it, what is the maturity and everything like that. So there may be some other aspect. You know what I'm saying? And then you have those, because what I mentioned, that would be more, and then you go back to those who joined in the 60s. You always have to, when it comes to Varnashram, categorize them very differently. Those that personally lived with Prabhupada, did everything with Prabhupada and all that, their thing is they're very strict on it's got to be how Prabhupada did it. And anything new, which they see Varnashram stuff, that's new. They're not very interested. Because their point was this, you just do it like this, how Prabhupada first introduced it. Though he talks about Varnashram, but they didn't see it at the time or couldn't understand it. And so they just stick to what they saw with Prabhupada. It worked, and that's all they push. And it does work. So they have to be in another category. You understand? So you have to be able to make these categories. Then you can apply this. Otherwise, if you apply across the board and anyone who doesn't support immediately, then you may make mistakes. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. The tendency in this age of Kali to make a classless society and not observe the principles of Varna Ashram is a manifestation of an impossible dream. Right? So he mentions the tendency of Kali Yuga. Right? So it's not a preaching technique, it's just the tendency of Kali Yuga. Destruction of the social and spiritual orders will not bring fulfillment of the idea of a classless society. One should strictly observe the principles of Varna Ashram for the satisfaction of the Creator. For it is stated in the Bhagavad Gita by Lord Krishna that the four orders of the social system, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra, are His creation. They should act according to the regulative principles of this institution and satisfy the Lord, just as different parts of the body all engage in the service of the whole. Because we're all taking our position as parts of the body of the Lord. But if we say classless, then we're just saying that the Lord is impersonal. So the idea of the classless society, we think we're being more personal. That's the problem. Is the liberal thinks he's being more personal. He's actually being more impersonal. Does that make sense? So that's the funny part. This may be a stretch, but it's more impersonal means, let's say you take those who are conservative. In general, they don't like liberals, but they specifically don't like this liberal or that liberal. You understand? But liberals just don't like conservatives across the board. It doesn't matter who they are. Right?
Somebody says.
Because they're more impersonal. But it's cloaked and they think they're being more personal because they worry about the individual, but they only worry about making the individual into a classless element of a classless society. So that's the mode of modes of ignorance. It makes everything upside down. You know, but and in the same way is that they feel they're universal. The conservatives also feel they're universal because what they do works. Say what you want, but what the conservatives do work. Why do they do what they do? Because it works. But in doing it, there'll be some weakness. And that weakness is generally to do with the individual. That's what then the liberal sees. And then they try to rectify what is the problem with the individual, but in doing that, they lose what works. They lose the standards. Does that make sense? So then, this is what the Vedic is it's the middle path, the real middle path. Because it takes the standards of the conservative and the liberal aspects of the individual and combines those perfectly, and by following all the Vedic rules. So that means you have to know it very well to be able to use it spontaneously. You know what I'm saying? The difficulty is that the Western idea is that the maverick is the standard. Right? He's the maverick. He's untrained. He doesn't know anything, but he's clever. And so when push comes to shove, he does stuff that people that have been trained their whole life can't do. Isn't that great? That's Hollywood. Right? So, you know, and it's a box office hit. People spend, you know, hundreds of millions or billions to watch a guy like that do that. Because what does that mean? Then me, a guy, ordinary guy who knows nothing, put me in the right situation and I get my, you know, my mojo going, you know, like that, and then I will save the world. No? You know, like that. So, like Prabhupada said, it's an impossible dream. Like that. So that's why people pay money, because they're kind of hoping for some inspiration that the dream's still viable. Right? So when a good movie comes out, then yeah, or a good book comes out, or a good, you know, paper, or anything that good that supports that, yes, you can control and enjoy the material world and be happy. Then it's immediately, you know, a bestseller. Does that make sense? Yeah. So the four orders are his creation. They should act according to, if they're God's creation, who are we to say that they don't apply? It's archaic. Who are we? But we take strength in numbers. If by vox populi I can prove that, you know, we are the, you know, the champions here, then, you know, then we're going to go for it. You know, God's one person, we're many, so hey, we're right. You know? Right? They should act according to the regulative principles of this institution and satisfy the Lord, just as different parts of the body all engage in the service of the Lord. The whole is the Supreme Personality of Godhead in His Virat Rup, or universal form. Because right? That's where all the eyes, ears, nose, and everything that everybody has comes from. The Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras are respectively the mouth, arms, abdomen, and legs of the universal form of the Lord. As long as they are engaged in the service of the complete whole, their position is secure. Otherwise, they fall down from their respective positions and become degraded. That. So that's the thing. You follow, it maintains. You don't follow, it becomes degraded. So they're secure. So that means everybody. But now in this modern society, this classless society, who's secure? At any time, anybody can go down. That's the thing. Nobody's secure. Right? So that's the thing. Is that in the idea of it's like this. okay, you're, let's say your Kshatriyas and your Brahmins are secure if you go back, you know, hundreds of thousand years or so like that. You go back a few two and a half thousand years before that, the Brahmins were very secure. Then the Kshatriyas come up, like that. Then in the Age of Enlightenment, or in Renaissance, you could say, then the Vaishyas come up. And then now the Shudras come up. But the problem is that as you drop these, what they do is, you say it comes up, all it is that you drop the others. If you have Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra on the bottom, then you get, you bring in the Ionians, bring in the relativists, and you drop the Brahmins. Now it looks like I moved up. Then you get rid of all the kings and all that, you drop the Kshatriyas. Right? Then, you know, all the Vaishyas are there, and then you take them all to some, you know, stalag somewhere in Russia. Then you drop them. Then it looks like the Shudras have come up. No, everybody's still in the bottom. And how are the Shudras secure? By the top, the leaders leading in a way that supports them, not by getting rid of them. Does that make sense? So that's the thing. So that's the problem. The classless society, it looks like you brought everybody up and made everyone equal. No, you brought everyone down, so everyone's on the bottom. Everybody is insecure. And then we all pat each other on the back and say we've done a great job. You know, we're forward thinkers, we're revolutionaries, you know, we're dynamic. How is bringing everyone down to the bottom dynamic? That's like saying you sat there and spent so much time, you know, building something up like this, and, you know, you spent hours getting all the cards like that, and then the three-year-old comes along and touches it, and it falls over. So that means the three-year-old is the dynamic, progressive, you know, person, while you're just the, you know, caught in the archaic, you know, ancient, controlled, and all that kind of stuff like that. You know? Mom worked so hard, you know, like that went out, was looking for it, finally found it, this one vase she had seen, you know, at some place, and she gets it, puts it on the table, and then the kid knocks it off on the floor. The kid's the dynamic, you know, liberator of, you know, the world, while the mom is the archaic, you know, like that, it's a, you know, the old regime. You understand? But it's just by changing the words and all that, you spin doctor and make it look like the kid's the one that's really doing all the great stuff. That's the benefit of the modern. The niti is used to destroy the culture rather than support it. Vedic means niti should support dharma. Then you'll have artha. But niti is just used for niti's sake, and you think you'll get artha. And how much artha does anybody have? You know, it's like since when? The early 2000s, there's been kind of basically recessions all over the world. It's never like been up, right? So I mean, it means that's not good. You know, economically, that's not good. But everyone's claiming, oh, we've got the answer. We know how everything works, right? We're the modern people. We know how to make everything function. So that's where we started from. Is even though they're so committed to sense gratification that they so meagerly, how much do they have? How much do they have? You know? Like I was saying, this one devotee was chanting japa one morning. You know, goes out on the street early morning, so it's before anyone's on the street. And he goes by and he sees this big, like black, probably a Lincoln. Wasn't a stretch, but, you know, Lincoln's considered, at least in those days, one of these top cars. You know, it would be, let's say, if you're in Europe and you see, you know, what's the biggest of the Mercedes? You know, it's the big four-door with, you know, it's bigger than anything. Huh? No, the Mercedes. You know, or an Audi, you have the Audi 8. You know, you have the luxurious model. It's not a stretch. It's just the most luxurious of that model. So then the Lincoln's like that in America. That's how they consider it. So he's going by, and as he's just walking by, the door opens, and very stale air comes out. And then this guy gets out, and in the window is hanging a suit, a nice suit. And the guy gets out, and that he's been sleeping in the car. And somehow another, a conversation starts. How, I don't know, what they like this. But basically what you know, is gleaned for our, you know, information here, is that that guy lives in that car. That's all he owns. He doesn't have a house. He doesn't have anything. All he has, all his money is in that suit and that car, and then whatever, you know, pocket money he has to spend at the nightclubs. So from the external, he looks like he's, you know, a high roller. Fancy car, fancy. It's not a, it's a good suit. You know, you're talking about these thousands of dollars suits, you're talking this top of the line car. So he drives into these places and that he looks good. But that's all he's got. And so before we would laugh at that. But now as people have one room in a building, one room, and they're spending ridiculously amount of money. But they have good clothes. They have no kitchen. They have no family. They have no nothing, right? They just got this one room. But when they're out on the street, they're considered good. So it's just a matter of time. So basically what it is that the car is hard to park, so therefore you rent an apartment because then you've already paid for the parking, right? You park yourself, the apartments, you're paying for parking. Does that make sense? So that's the thing, is that even though it's saying it's progressive, how much are they enjoying? That's the sad part. That's the sad part. So that's what Prabhupada's pointing out, is that neither are they getting anywhere spiritually, and neither are they getting anywhere material. It's one thing is if you had this fabulous material society that was so successful, stable, everything was working so nicely, and then we're saying give that up and just be renounced and be Krishna conscious. But we're saying no. You see, the Vedic culture, that's the one where all the culture was. That's where we started here. Is that all opulence, all anything of value in the West, all comes from India. So that therefore, then that's the difficulty. Is that even though people are trying, so when they introduce the modern, that will solve the problems of the society. It doesn't. It never has. Right, and as Prabhupada pointed out, never will.
Before the break, India.
Means I was saying about all the things that are considered luxury come from here. Silk, smells. Where you ever heard of vetiver? Hmm? Vetiver, sandalwood, kush, kas. All these things, they all come from here. Like that, you know, all your spices, like that. The only thing that the West has is, oregano's over there. Tulsi's Carmi cousin lives over there. You know, like that. But otherwise, not a whole lot. Black peppers from over here, all these things are from over there. You know, all the fine cloth, everything like that. You know, in the West, cashmere, where is that from? Kashmir. You know, you understand? You know, those made out of cashmere, but it's just a flat piece of cloth that you put on, wears a, you know, a wrap or that. You know, what's it called? It's called the pashmina. That's what the Karmis call it. That's what they call it here, but you know, it's what it's made out of.
So these luxuries,
they all come from here.
Do they exist because...
That's another what I'm pointing out is the ideas, the Vedic culture, somehow or another I'm not going to get enjoyment out of it. You know, I'm restricted. But all it is you're restricting, and then within that area you expand. You know what I'm saying? So it's just like anything you do. Okay, if I say you have cooking, let's say, okay, there's Mexican. Oh, so much restriction. No, but within that, there's tons of variety. Each cuisine has so much, but if you understand the principles, then it... You know what I'm saying? So that's the thing, is you're coming from a non-Vedic background, and then we see that the Vedic restricts, So then we think, you know, where's going to be my control and enjoyment? Because that's the bottom line. Why would anybody reject the Vedic system if it's not affecting their control and enjoyment or the gain and safety? Right? So like that. The, you know, is it better the devil you know than the devil you don't? So like that, then they're happier like that. But what I'm pointing, it was not, we're not trying to establish that that is the fact. What we're pointing out is that all the luxury things and all that we consider come from here. So that means the Vedic culture can accommodate all those things, all the positions of society, all the everything like that.
Yeah, because people see India as important.
That's because they don't have the eyes to see. You know, I could take you to places anywhere and you can see like that. You know what I'm saying?
No, I mean, that's why they don't have faith.
Yeah, and so why is that? Okay, let's see. If you see the person's money and you don't have money, then you get envious. Right? Right? As we see in the European scene, those with money never got on so well. You know? Like that. They like to, you know, stick them in little camps and make them work until they're liberated. That's the popular thing. It's been that way for the last 2,000 years. Right? Because you can see their money. The Indians are very clever and you don't see their money. Huh? I'm just saying it's that she's saying you can't see it, they don't have faith. Because if they do see it, they don't have faith either. You know what I'm saying? The point is if somebody has something you don't have, it's just envious. It's not a matter of that, okay, let me do that. You know what I'm saying? Why not think working very hard, very industrious, have a sense of community, work together, support each other? Why won't that make economy work? But instead of doing that, you get rid of people who do that. You understand? So, even we're saying, if you could see the wealth, Mathura, the deities were made of gold. I'm not talking about before, I'm talking about when Aurangzeb, you know, was having his little pastimes. You know, and Baba, you know, those six, you know, how you say, guests from up north. Right? So when they came in, they took the gold deities, either, you know, that, sold them this and that, or tied ropes around them, put them behind a horse, and drove the horse around the city until the deity disappeared just into the ground. It means it just wore off. The amount of wealth that was in, why would people come to India? Why is it, why would anybody come here to conquer if there's no wealth? Right? You know, it's been a big major thing that, you know, some little out-of-the-way place, that's where everybody's going. No, it's because there's some kind of wealth there.
And they didn't follow the Vedic culture. When the wealth was very obvious. And so they didn't say India is poor.
Yeah, it was just like this. Is South America considered poor or rich?
Rich in natural products.
Is it considered poor or rich? Don't be politically correct. Just state what, how people look at South America. Poor. Okay. Now, if you go back in history a few hundred years, where did all the wealth of Spain and Portugal and those places come from? It didn't come from Spain and Portugal. You know what I'm saying? It came from South America. You understand? So it's like, where is the wealth of Europeans? Where's all their raw material? Where's their labor force? Where's everything? Where is anything done? All they do is control it from them. Where is the natural stuff? If you built a wall around Europe and told them to stay inside, they'd probably all starve to death. You know? Except for the Poles, you know. They're going to farm anyway. Right? You know what I'm saying? So if they go on in this lifestyle, then they're not going to get anywhere. So I'm saying is that all these net come from somewhere else. So the point is you have it, they take it. You know what I'm saying? It's just like this. Guy in the West has money, you know he's got money. But I heard about rich businessmen saying that sometimes they have to do something with cash. So he'll have a bag, and in the bag will be 10 lakhs. Then that was a lot of money. That would be like saying maybe there's 50 lakhs in a bag, or, you know? And he'll put it in a funky bag, you know, that those kind of funky bags that the suppliers show up with, those funny kind of knit plastic ones that are falling apart and look disgusting. You wouldn't even want to touch it, right? He'll stick all the money in there, and on top of it, put a bunch of vegetables. And then he's walking around his t-shirt with holes in it and everything else like that. He's walking down the street. So everyone think, oh, here goes another poor guy. You know, and another one from his community goes, wow, he must be carrying a lot of money. So therefore you have the element as you think they're poor because you don't know what to look for. What Westerners actually have money. We take it middle class is okay, but middle class means you have enough to scrape by and a little extra to spend on a little few gizmos and gadgets. But you have to plan it very well. Middle class doesn't have a lot of money. They're okay. But they wouldn't know what money looked like if it hit them in the head. You know what I'm saying? Why do brand names have to have big names on it so that people know what you got? You ever notice that the big brands that used to be obvious what they were changing the designs so you can't tell what they are? You know what I'm saying? You know, stuff that was very obvious before, that was theirs, then if everybody else gets into it, then they switch to something that no one knows what it is. People from that class know, but others. So what I'm saying is, people come in, they see the rickshaw wallahs standing outside the airport, they see the taxi driver, they see all the guys along the road, they see the guys out the front gate, they come into Mayapur, they see the lady from Tarinpur that comes and cleans their house, and that's their full understanding of India. So that means they don't know what they're looking for. Does that make sense? Yeah. If you want to have fun, look up on the internet BRIC. BRIC, B-R-I-C. And then apply your theory. Brick, you know, everyone knows brick.
Brick-a-brac?
No. Brick. Brazil, Russia, India, China. Okay. O most auspicious Lord, you have ordained the heavenly planets, the spiritual Vaikuntha planets, and the impersonal Brahman sphere as the respective destinations of the performance of auspicious activities. Similarly, for others who are miscreants, you have destined different kinds of hells, which are horrible and ghastly. Yet sometimes it is found that their destinations are just the opposite. It is very difficult to ascertain the cause of this, right? Sometimes someone like Duryodhana, so bad, is in such a high position. Or someone like Daksha, who is so envious, but he's a Prajapati. So he's saying it's very hard to ascertain. Srila Prabhupada explains the meaning of the statement. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is called the Supreme Will. It is by the Supreme Will that everything is happening. It is said, therefore, that not a blade of grass moves without the Supreme Will. Generally, it is prescribed that performers of pious activities are promoted to the higher planetary systems. Devotees are promoted to the Vaikuntha, or spiritual worlds. And impersonal speculators are promoted to the impersonal Brahman effulgence. But it sometimes so happens that a miscreant like Ajamiya is immediately promoted to the Vaikuntha Loka simply by chanting the name of Narayana. Although when Ajamiya uttered this vibration, he intended to call his son Narayana. Lord Narayana took it seriously and immediately gave him promotion to Vaikuntha Loka, despite his background, which was full of sinful activities. Similarly, like so this is a problem for us. No, if he's pious, he gets good results. If he's sinful, then why can't I be like that? You understand? That's the difficulty. It's not that, okay, someone's pious, someone's sinful, but if they connect themselves to the Lord, that's the actual real point. But that's working on principle. but working on the secondary, then you look at this guy's good, this guy's bad. Why should a bad guy get any benefit? We're not saying he's getting material benefit, we're saying he's getting spiritual benefit. But our idea, bad people can't get any benefit. Because if you're bad, you can't even be spiritual. And if you're good, you're automatically spiritual. So that's a problem. Similarly, King Daksha was always engaged in the pious activities of performing sacrifices. Yet, simply because of creating a little misunderstanding with Lord Shiva, he was severely taken to task. The conclusion is, therefore, that the Supreme... Right? Here's a person who's always sinful. He does a small thing. He gets elevated to Vaikuntha Loka. Daksha, he's doing this big thing. He's always doing pious stuff and all that, but he does one small infraction and he's destroyed. So he's saying, how is this understood? But we see it's a connection to the Lord. So, in other words, your greatest results are in connection with the Lord. So the greatest spiritual and the greatest material are coming from the Lord. And if it's against the Lord, then the greatest reduction in spiritual and the greatest reduction in material then comes. Is this me? Yep. The conclusion is, therefore, that the supreme will is the ultimate judgment. No one can argue upon this. A pure devotee, therefore, submits in all circumstances to the supreme will of the Lord, accepting it as all auspicious. Because we don't know all things. We think we know everything. But we don't. Krishna knows our nature, what we've done. We think, I'm doing this now for the first time. There's a good chance that what you do now is what you've been doing for a lot of lifetimes. You know, the particular things that are of interest that you like to do, the particular attachments, the particular things like this is something we've been doing for some time. You know, and so now we're getting the opportunity to connect that to the Lord. That's the special. Now, how that response will be, we're thinking, yeah, I'm just doing this, but how deep something is that we don't know, or how far we got in an area before not that being stopped, that we don't know.
Tate nukampam shushami shamano bunjana evatma kritam vipakam puridvag vapurabhir viranan namaste jiveta yo mukti pade sadhaya bhak. Srimad Bhagavatam 10:14:8.
The purport of this verse is that when a devotee is in a calamitous condition, he takes it as a benediction of the Supreme Lord and takes responsibility himself for his past deeds. In such a condition, he considers still more devotional service. No, in such a condition, he offers still more devotional service and is not disturbed. One who lives in such a disposition of mind engaged in devotional service is the most eligible candidate for promotion to the spiritual world. In other words, such a devotee's claim. Such a devotee's claim for promotion to the spiritual world is assured in all circumstances. Quote, my dear Lord, devotees who have fully dedicated their lives under your lotus feet certainly observe your presence as Paramatma in each and every being, and as such they do not differentiate between one living being and another. Such persons treat all living entities equally, right? That's the living entities equally, not the conditioning. The souls are all equal, but the conditionings are different. Right? Just like I'm going to make some vegetable, vegetables are all equal in that they're all vegetables. Right? But, at the same time, how I deal with each vegetable. Right? I don't have something, I like this vegetable, I don't like that vegetable. It's just as is there, whatever's the season, what's available, you cook that. So you're equal to all vegetables. But how you cook each vegetable has to be different, otherwise you're an idiot. It's that simple. So the whole thing is if you can't make the distinction, so the point of being equal means you see everything on the spiritual platform. Right? And you know how the material energy works. Otherwise, then how is that intelligent? Right? It's just sentimental. So that's the thing, is that those who are sentimental try to present themselves that we're the intelligent, scientific, modern people. And the people who are scientific, they're saying, oh, you're just sentimental, you know, just, you know, following this archaic system. You understand how the mode of ignorance twists? In other words, the mode of ignorance is the original spin doctor. Right? And you don't even have to be trained. It just comes naturally. Right? Why does the mom want the kid to actually eat? Why does they want him to do their homework? Why do they want him to dress properly or not go to situations that might be dangerous? Out of affection? Or because they hate the kid? Huh? Sorry? Yeah. So, now, according to the mom, it's because of the affection. According to the teenagers, that's because they hate them. So that's the spin doctoring of the mode of ignorance. It just happens naturally. You don't even have to worry about it. They never become overwhelmed by anger like animals who can see nothing without differentiation. Right? They can't make any distinction. They can't tell what's spiritual, what's not, this and that. What's of value, what's not. All they know is this, their senses. What they take as favorable, then as good, and what they in the moment take as not favorable, then they become angry. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur writes in his commentary to verse 46, excuse me, "The cause is my anger or mercy," end quote. But that cannot be. It is only your mercy and not your anger. This is expressed by Kai Muktya Nyaya. If anger does not arise in the devotees, how could it arise in you? The devotees desire to see you, Tava, in all beings, and see all beings as non-different from you, Paramatma, Atmani. Or they desire to see all beings as non-different from themselves, experiencing others' happiness or distress as their own. If those who desire to see in that way do not become angry with devotees, then what to speak of those who actually see in this way? The devotees do not act as animals which become angry, generally speaking. This indicates certain exceptions, such as the Kumara's anger at Jayambijai or your anger at Daksha, even though you are self-satisfied. Persons who observe everything with differentiation, who are simply attached to fruit of activities, who are mean-minded, who are always pained to see the flourishing condition of others, and who thus give distress to them by uttering harsh and piercing words, have already been killed by providence. Right? So here Brahma is putting all these together. Those who don't make differentiation are attached to fruit of mean mind, always pained to see the flourishing condition of others. So you'll see, along with the modernism, there's always a pain that no one should get ahead. Everybody should be equal, but everybody should be equal on the lowest level. Does that make sense? Right? Nobody should be poor, but nobody should be rich. So you can only move within middle class. Upper middle class, that's stretching it. Middle class is okay. Lower middle class, you're already, you know, people are feeling bad for you. You understand? That's the world of the modern. So anything outside of it, they can't tolerate. That's why there's no money in that world. And that's why there's no real welfare in that world. Individuals, maybe, but in general, no. You understand? Because of this, they can't, they are pained to see the flourishing condition of others, and thus give distress to them by uttering harsh and piercing words. Right? And so, what's the best way to do harsh and piercing words? You can't do it as a person, because then they'll get you back for it. You do it as a committee. You understand? That's why the moving to that kind of thing. Not because, oh, it gets more people involved, it means I can hide better. Yes?
This sounds like a softened version of the demoniac ones is described in the Bhagavad Gita.
It is, but the point is it's Kali Yuga, we're conditioned by these things. So it's only if we only if we take Krishna as the primary element, then we can get rid of this. Ideal if we can recognize it and then work to rectify that, it makes it a little bit quicker. But even if not, if Krishna's kept as the primary, the system still works, though it's rough. when you accept these things, then it makes the system work more carefully. That's what Prabhupada is saying, that never can you neglect the Vedic system, because that's what makes things run. But the Vedic system on its own, without its primary element of Krishna consciousness, is then is what's the meaning? You know, it's like if I have a car and I just have it, like I have an extension on my house where I just have it sitting in a nice, you know, open room, it got glass on three sides and all that. It's never driven and everything like that. What's the point? There's no real... The point is that cars are driven. They do things. So the Vedic culture, if it doesn't end up in Krishna consciousness, what's the use of it? So that doesn't mean it's useless. It means without Krishna consciousness, then, which is its point, then that's useless. But devotees will take it that, oh, Varnashram is useless. Prabhupada's pointing out, he opens that human life begins with Varnashram. You see it quite regularly. You know? Then, having said that, because it's been explained very nicely quite regularly, then he'll point out how you have to be very careful not to miss the point and get distracted in Varnashram by the externals. You always have to keep in focus the primary elements of what it's for. And so because he spent two paragraphs explaining how to be careful of using it, therefore we shouldn't use it. Just like I'm saying, yeah, the good knives are over there, but be very careful, they're very sharp, and they got this kind of edge, and this and that, so my conclusion is, oh, don't use the knives. No, all it is pointing out how to be careful with something. Right? Does that make sense? Let's say I have the plastic lid off of a baby formula can. Okay? We all can picture that? Right? Okay. Now, let us say, okay, that we're going to prepare the potatoes. So you take that plastic lid, you peel them, you cut them up and all that, and then I'm going, no, then we'll cook them. Okay? Can you do a lot with that plastic lid? Okay. Now, are there any dangerous things I have to warn you about this plastic lid? You know, dynasties have fallen due to these plastic lids. You know, great hopefuls and prominence in all fields of science, religion, economics, you know, and education have fallen by the misapplication of these plastic lids. Yes? No. It means basically it's too big to stick in your mouth, so there's nothing really you could do to injure yourself with this plastic lid. Right? So are there any rules about these being dangerous? No, it does nothing, and it's not dangerous. Now, a knife does something. A huge amount of things in our life are done with knives. But that means also it's dangerous. So when I say follow the Vedic system, right? When the acharyas say like this, that also means you have to point out the weaknesses, because it is powerful. It is real. Well, we look at, oh, there's no faults in the modern because it does nothing. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't get anybody anywhere. If it got anybody anywhere, there's a good chance it would be very... nobody would have joined this movement. Right? How many were just there sitting in their house and thought, I really got to know the Supreme Personality of Godhead in His form, you know, in Braj Vrindavan, in His loving pastimes with Radha, you know, with Radharani and all the residents of Vrindavan. And then they went out and started looking around, you know. Right? No. Artha Artarti Jigyasu. That's basically what we're talking about. Right? Yes. Just one voice, small question, it has no relevance, but when you were small, did you used to cry a lot? I mean, really small as a baby. Yeah.
I don't think so.
No? Okay.
No. Or maybe. Why?
No, it's just something you can ask your mom.
Oh. So I was talking to a Malvari devotee.
You were talking to?
Marwari,
okay. Yeah.
So it was really interesting because he was explaining how the people that was under him, he would allow them to, like, somehow he would trust them a lot so that they can raise above him. He would train them in such a way that they could flourish more than himself. So I was, and he would give them full trust. So I was wondering whether his, you know, progress, actually expansion and everything, is very much connected to the trust and lack of envy.
Yeah, because there's no, the Vedic system means there cannot be authority issues. The modern system as it is, if you don't have authority issues, then you're not considered a normal person. If you actually trust authority, there's something wrong with you. You know what I'm saying? So it's based on lack of trust of authority. That's where the trust issue comes. So when you say someone's got trust issues, it means trust in authority. And so then that comes down to everybody. If you don't trust authority, why would you trust anybody else? Because they trust authority, therefore, then they can do these things. So that's the difference. Your paradigm that you're starting from is so different. But because that's not understood or known, therefore the externals are looked at and seen. Because the point is, it's like this. You've talked to a Marwari businessman. How many devotees in this movement who are Westerners have ever talked to a Marwari businessman? Like if you just go through this community here who live here, how many have talked to one? Other than taking them to the temple, show them the deities there, but actually taught how they live. And that's who lives here. Right? Let alone those who aren't in India. So they wouldn't have a clue what India is, its culture, and where it goes. They wouldn't have a clue. And then based on that, Ben, so therefore give a dog a bad name and hang it. You pick out some points that you really don't understand and that are a problem in the modern society. Bring those out, show that it's bogus, and so if this is wrong, like if I, you know, the rice, I just squeeze one rice and I can tell the whole, so they just take one thing and then from that see the whole the thing's bad, and then they can sit back comfortably and say, I can go on with my conditioning and no one can bother me. You know what I'm saying? And that's a bit simplistic, but if we look at the underlying effect, we might find that simplicity is frighteningly true. There may be other things on the surface, but the real reason that people are against the Vedic culture is just because they all these things. They observe everything with differentiation. That's the thing, is the Vedic is without differentiation. And the modern is totally with differentiation. But they present that we're the ones that are not. Right? Just like how did Daksha open his speech when he was going to insult Shiva? What was the first thing he said? Yeah, it says, I'm not envious here. I'm just speaking based on cultured principles. That's the first thing that's going to come out of anybody's mouth. We're just being broad-minded. We're just looking at it objectively. But what about this? But if you can point out a million of those. I mean, karmis, there are websites dedicated to finding fault on all levels of modern society. But that's his opinion. He's just disgruntled. Oh, that was because this happened. And then we write it off. So we can write that off. Why can't we write off all the Vedic ones? No, but those are like dyed in the wool, written in, you know, carved in stone, and that is just totally like that. Why? Because that's the way we are. Shiva's not envious, and he's saying he is. So saying that the Vedic culture is poor, you'd only say that if you were poor. A rich man can see how the wealth works. A rich man could come and look at these rickshaw wallahs and learn something. Right? Because they don't normally look. How does the guy keep his money? He looks poor. He's a rickshaw wallah. You think he's not getting some money? Where's his money? How do you see it? Like this. Okay. Now let's take a Westerner. Okay? They come and they got, you know, let's say $1,000. Okay? Where do you keep it? Right? In your pocket? No, you put it in one of those little pouches, right? Keep it safe. Okay? Now, does everybody know what one of those pouches is? Everybody on the planet, do they know that's what you keep money in? Money, passports, all that stuff? Or is it some secret hidden thing that nobody knows? Everybody knows. Okay, now let's say that Westerner goes to the pawn shop or whatever it is and he buys a drink. Okay? Cost them whatever it is. What do they cost now? 20 rupees or 15, 10? Huh? How much is it? Whole drink? 30. 30? Wow. Okay. So, 30 rupees. Now, what's he going to do? He's going to unzip that pouch and pull 30 rupees out where there's, you know, there's thousands and thousands of stuff. Okay? Now, the rickshaw wala. He's got a couple of hundred rupees on his body. Where is it? You don't see it. What's in his pocket? 2 or 3 rupees. So he knows I'm going out for this kind of purchasing. I may need, you know, let's say like this Western is going out. I may need when I'm moving around, you know, on the street, I may need 100 rupees. He's got 100 rupees in his pocket, or maybe 150 just to make sure. And he's got the rest in a place. You can't see it. You don't know he's got it. And now we're going to say India's poor. You know what I'm saying?
Just remembering a friend of mine here in Mayapur, she was invited for prasad to a devotee, Bengali couple, that apparently poor, I mean, according to the Western, but then she went to their place, and it was basically empty, but it was a big feast, like I think somebody rich could get.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And the deity was most beautiful, socially dangerous.
They know where to put invest their money. That's the point. Rich people know where to put their money. Poor people don't. Middle class doesn't know what to do with money because they're not trained to know what to do with money. You understand? Because if they know what to do with money, rich people aren't rich. Not in the modern system. Modern system is to be rich, someone's got to be poor. So who's the poor? The middle class. Because the poor people, they think, I'm poor. They don't spend money. The middle class, though they are poor, they think, I'm rich. And so they spend money. That's why they're poor. So they don't know how to do it because they don't say, okay, he's got money. He doesn't have all the gizmos and gadgets I have. No, but there's a good chance each rickshaw wala there has more property and more money than the average foreign devotee here in Mayapur. Guaranteed. Back in the 70s, all the guys, the ripped t-shirt, you know, if you've seen the t-shirt, it means nowadays a little less, but before, if it didn't fall off your back, they'd wear it, the t-shirt. Right? When it fell off, you know, when they went to take it off and it ripped in half, that's when they, you know, put on the next one. Okay? So, but at that time, there was 50 lakhs in this local Mayapur bank. It means all these guys here, the farmers here that we're just thinking are dirt poor, they got 50 lakhs in the bank. And in those days, 50 lakhs was a lot of money. We asked a rich man for 1,000 rupees to become a member. Because that was 1,000 was a lot of money. You could buy an acre of land. You understand an acre? Huh?
1 acre is 3 bigas.
3 bigas, but she doesn't know. If she doesn't know acres, she's not going to go bigas. She's talking about square meters.
Yeah.
So what it is in meters? You know hectares? Oh well, whatever it is. A piece of, means most plots that people buy these days, the house on, are what? 3 kuttas? 5 kuttas? 5 kuttas is average, right? And those little things like that. There's 20 of those to a biga, right? And there's 3, you know, so there's 60 of those, no, there's 5 to 20, 60 of those to an acre. Okay? So you used to be able to buy, back in the 70s, an acre of land. That means the plots of, what did they say, 60 houses over there. Right? That's a huge area. 60 houses over there, what they're sitting on, for 1,80,000. And before that, it was even less. That was depending on where it is. You could even get it for 60,000 rupees. You understand what we're talking about? So I'm just saying this so you get the understanding that 50 lakhs of rupees is a lot of money. But you look at them, they're poor. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So that's the thing, is that they know, the point is that Indians, when they have like a huge amount of money, then you'll start seeing a little bit. So you'll never be, the air aspect that you see is 1/10 of what they are. You know, while Western, it'll basically be kind of what they are, even a little beyond, because they got a credit card. You know what I'm saying? But so if you see him, you know, if you see him wearing he's got a new shirt, and it's a nicer shirt, it's not one of the cheapo shirts, that means he's got a ton of money. And then when you see him in an Armani suit, you know this guy's like, you know, stinking rich. You know what I'm saying? It's just that the distance between what they show and that. So that's the thing. In India, it's looked that they're poor, but they got more, probably more money than anybody else.
And why?
Because they know how to deal with it. They're humans. That's why. You can't expect animals to know what to do with money.
That is my worry. The body, he was saying that he never wears fancy clothes, and he said he has.
Because it goes out of fashion. You buy it, and in 6 months, it's stupid. And so why get it? You find also the established rich in the West, they only buy classic stuff. You know, it's got some. It's fashionable, but it's always in fashion. You know, there's always things, oh, pleats are in, pleats are out, cuffs are in, cuffs are out. But the stuff that they have with pleats and cuffs, they can wear it anytime, anywhere, and you know who they are. You know what I'm saying? So that's the thing, is they only invest in, he buys stuff, but he only buys stuff that will stay in fashion. You know, and then according to his sophistication, he'll be at that. So most Marwaris are like villagers. They live in the city, but they're villagers, so they're simple. Those that have been in the city for generations, they're a little bit different. Same principles, but you'll see them a little more refined in how they deal and dress. Okay? Do we understand? So what we're trying to bring out is that when you make these differentiations in that, then like the animals, you don't have any more than the animals. It looks like a nice show, but, you know, so much difficulty. Right? I remember in Calcutta, it doesn't, any time of the day or not, you can walk around in the street and you never have to worry. Never. Like that. But then, you know, in these major so-called, you know, developed, you know, major cities of the world, if you're not in the right place, you know, there's a problem. And the amazing thing is some of these places are the biggest, you know, what do you call it? Like a Rio, right? The beach, one of the highest end resort kind of things. But you step, you know, 5 feet out of where you should be, and that's it. You're done. You're gone. Like that. Cape Town's the same. Right? Fabulous thing. Resort. If you stay right in that neighborhood, only go stay here and there, you're fine. Go from there to the airport, out, and then you're okay. But you walk down the street, that may be your last walk. Right? Like that. So that's the thing. But Calcutta, which is, this, you know, basically you could say is one big dustpan or dustbin, you know, is, you know, one of the most safest places in the world. You can walk down, you don't even feel uncomfortable. Sorry? That's another thing. Yeah, of course. So you enjoy. Okay. Does this make some sense? Yeah. Okay. Shiva says, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, Shiva says, but if I do not give suitable punishment out of anger, then everyone would become sinful since they would not get results for their sinful acts. He's saying if people are sinful and there's not a reaction, they would continue to be sinful. Therefore, that's why he gives, because he's asking, why is it sometimes it's this way, sometimes that way? Paro dayena means by seeing the wealth of others. Arun tuda means they injure. Killed by karma means that by their offenses, dakshas and others will die. You should not kill them, because if they become the object of your anger, then they will never have the chance to become saved in the future. Right? So you have to make a balance. Thus, there is no need for them to be killed again by an exalted personality like you. My dear Lord, and if in some places, materials, he's saying already by their karma they're going to be destroyed, so there's no need for you to kill them again. They're going to be killed now by you, and their karma is going to get them later. Right? So he's saying there's no need. Their karma is going to take care of it. But at the same time, he's also mentioned he's in control of these things. My dear Lord, if in some places materialists who are already bewildered by the insurmountable illusory energy of the Supreme Godhead
sometimes commit offenses. A saintly person with compassion does not take this seriously, knowing that they commit offenses because they are overpowered by the illusory energy. He does not show his prowess to counteract them. The example of Maharaj Prakrit is given by Srila Prabhupada in his purport to verse 48. It is said that the beauty of a tapasvi, or saintly person, is forgiveness. There are many instances in the spiritual history of the world in which many saintly persons, although unnecessarily harassed, did not take action, although they could have done so. Prakrit Maharaj, for example, was unnecessarily cursed by a Brahmin boy, and this was very much regretted by the boy's father. But Prakrit Maharaj accepted the curse and agreed to die within a week as the Brahmin boy desired. Prakrit Maharaj was the emperor and was full in power, both spiritually and materially. But out of compassion, out of respect of the Brahmana community, he did not counteract the action of the Brahmana boy, but agreed to die within 7 days. Because it was desired by Krishna that Prakrit Maharaj agree to the punishment, so that the instruction of Srimad Bhagavatam would thus be revealed to the world. Prakrit Maharaj advised not to take action. A Vaishnava is personally tolerant for the benefit of others. When he does not show his prowess, this does not mean that he is lacking in strength. Rather, it indicates he is tolerant for the welfare of the entire human society. So it's actually the strength. But now in this is that you also have to see as these things, the culture will go on. He steps down, another proper king will be in place. And the Brahminical culture will be maintained. So it's within the culture that there's a problem. Right, that's one thing. But when the problem is coming from outside the culture, that's a whole different thing. Does that make sense? So since our business is to establish Krishna consciousness, it's got to be what's going to be favorable to Krishna consciousness, not what's going to be favorable to modern so-called ideas of what is going to be good. Yes?
So if somebody's trying to attack their culture in a modern way, should we try to them?
It depends on who you are and what your position is. If you have some way to deal, yes, and if not, you don't. Point is you do your duties. So it's within the scope of your duties, you work within that. Does that make sense? So you don't have to worry outside of that. Does that make sense?
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaura.